world's most influential voices are driving the thought leadership and change necessary to take action and reduce the threat and severity of climate change. Join me, Roger Platt, president of the U.S. Green Building Council, as I speak to environmental leaders about the impact of the built environment when it comes to solutions to climate change on my podcast series, Climate Leaders. Today I'm here with Matthew Penchars, deputy mayor for the City of London. He works closely with Boris Johnson, the mayor, who's a very well-known figure in Great Britain, both as mayor but also in his past as a member of parliament, and is well-known also as a very thoughtful conservative with what in America we probably call libertarian views. And Matthew has been working closely with him on environmental policy matters and related land use matters. Matthew, welcome. And let me ask you a little quick question just on how it is you came to be working with Boris Johnson.
Well, I've known Boris for quite a while. And I worked for him when he was first an MP. And then I went to be a journalist at the BBC, where I did do quite a few environmental stories. And then about halfway through his first term, I was invited to join his administration. I think some other, I'm a Londoner. It's quite a hard thing to turn down, I suppose, and do something positive for your city. And then when he was re-elected 3.5 years ago in 2012, he asked me to do the environment job, which I've been very lucky to have been asked to do, something that I have covered as a journalist, but also I've been very, very interested in. I am a bit doctrinaire. My wife often complains about the recycling back home. So it was a good thing to pick up.
Well, that's great, Matthew. And of course, we've known each other for many years, and I've been very impressed that your background in journalism really helps you with one of the most important aspects of any high-profile job that the mayor has, which is to be effectively communicating about a topic that people find sometimes hard to digest. And so one of the things that I'd like you to talk a little bit about is just for those folks that are not aware of this, London has had significant population and economic growth in the past decade, and yet it has reduced carbon emissions by more than 16% net. So how in the world was that accomplished? And tell us a little bit about maybe how you used some of your communications journalistic skills to help persuade folks to be on the right side of history with that trend.
Well, yes, we have seen pretty remarkable reductions. London's population since the mayor was elected back in 2008 has been probably around 1 million people, and we're seeing growth of over 100,000, in fact, 120,000 people in the last year. And we've seen reductions. In fact, our last data says 14%, but 16, I'll go with 16%, Roger, since it's a 2% better figure, or a 20% reduction per capita. And that's despite our economic growth, which is 20% before inflation or 10% after. So we really feel that we have disconnected what was previously thought to be an inevitable increase in emissions, carbon emissions, when you have such prodigious economic but also certainly population growth, because all these people want to move around and they all consume things and, need to live in places and do jobs and things. So it really shows you that we're making real progress and that we can do this. We can have increased wealth and health and increased population, particularly in urban areas where you often have emissions per head, some of the lowest here in London, where we are the richest region with areas of deprivation, but we are the richest region and yet have considerably the lowest emissions per head. Now, how have we done that? Well, we have policies across all the sectors. So despite that population growth, the number of cars in the city has not really increased very much. Car ownership per head has clearly dropped. So we've seen a transfer,
Is that true throughout Great Britain? This sort of, in America, we have this issue where young people just aren't driving as or making such a big deal of driving as much as their parents did. Is that a UK trend generally, or are you just seeing less driving per capita in the London area?
It's certainly far more pronounced in London than it is elsewhere. I'd have to get back to you, I think, on the data about the countrywide, but I think when you hear about the certainly increased congestion, there certainly is outside London in many of the main roads. I don't think that is true, because the whole country is growing far faster, actually, than most European of our European neighbours when it comes to population in general, mainly centred in the southeast and certainly in London. The quite astonishing modal shift we've seen of people from motor cars to the tubes, to the trains, to cycling and to buses has been pretty astonishing. And we've really seen under the mayor, and in fairness under the former mayor too, a large investment in public transport capacity. So we've seen our tube lines being upgraded. Crossrail, Europe's biggest infrastructure project, which will add 10% to our rail capacity here in London, will complete in 3 years' time. The mayor today was effectively breaking ground on a extension to one of our tube lines to a huge redevelopment area in the inner south of our city. And in some areas, so a London borough called Hackney, which has seen gentrification at an astonishing rate in the last 10 years or so. So it's becoming a much wealthier borough. And yet car ownership is one of the lowest in all of London there. And by the way, it isn't necessarily one of the best served by public transport. So you've seen, a cultural change, I suppose, in large parts of London, onto public transport. So that's one thing. But at the same time, we've been greening our fleet. So our bus fleet now, with a combination of an air pollution problem, but also a carbon challenge, is now one of the cleanest and greenest in London. And we're going to have hundreds of electric buses hitting the streets over the next few years, as the mayor has said that all buses going into central London, if they're single deck, must be zero emission. They must be electric or hydrogen. And then we've also seen, programs to look at our energy supply and also energy efficiency measures in our building stock, which, by the way, is quite energy inefficient. We here in the UK have not had a culture of energy efficiency, arguably, until the last decade or so. And that's a history because of cheap oil and gas and previously coal that the UK has had. But it's a long answer to your opening question about how we've sort of communicated to people. Well, it's definitely been about efficiency. So it's effectively been about, I suppose, saving money. Everybody can understand an energy bill. Not many people, frankly, can understand kilograms of carbon. So what it really is efficiency. Being environmental is about business efficiency or domestic efficiency. It's about using less resources, having broadly the same lifestyle, perhaps, a bit of behaviour change, but using less resources, that means, frankly, spending less money.
Well, it sounds as though you've been able to put it in very practical terms, personal terms, and you have a sense for the some of the changes in behaviour, certainly around using mass transit. But as we know, at these big climate change conferences every year, it's often not just about what's being accomplished, but there's a lot about this focus on commitments. What is the target, the commitment? And, of course, I have a real place in my heart for the people that are just really focused on getting things done and a little less focused on the politics of commitments. But it seems as though, in addition to getting a lot of stuff done, you have set a very ambitious commitment and you're tracking progress on that. Can you tell us about that?
So we set a commitment, the current mayor back in 2008, around the time he was first elected, to reduce our carbon emissions by 60% from 1990 levels by 2025. And I was pleasantly surprised. I saw some of the data. We're making pretty good progress on that. It's a much more challenging target now because of the population increase that we didn't know about back in 2008. So it was difficult then. It is more difficult now because all those people, as I said, need to travel around and live somewhere. But we have set ourselves, it's good to set a difficult target. You don't want to set an easy one. It focuses the mind somewhat. And, we have programs to try and get within that target. We are relying somewhat on government action as well. Although, of course, the UK government, the new energy secretary said just last week that we will be, I think, the first developed country to get off coal, which certainly when it comes for the most amount of carbon mitigation for the amount of public money spent is the cheapest way to reduce your emissions. And that's the great news indeed, that we will be off carbon by mid-next decade.
Right. Well, that's just an extraordinary announcement. Again, in the United States, that kind of announcement is almost unimaginable. So the fact that you're combining doing more with less, being a place that people want to come to for all of the economic benefits that the city offers, and at the same time making progress on your 60% goal is really spectacular. What are some of the vehicles you have to share your strategies and some of your success stories with other mayors of major cities throughout the world? Tell us about how Boris Johnson connects with other mayors and ways in which the ideas in London have been tried in other places?
So we obviously have one-to-one relationships with other cities. So, for example, the mayor signed an MOU with Beijing to address air pollution particularly, obviously a real challenge for Beijing. But also we have a challenge of a different order of magnitude, certainly, but a challenge here in London as well. But also through our membership of the C40, which is the world's megacities and other cities involved in addressing climate change. He's the deputy chair of that organisation and sits on the steering committee. So we are, you know, doing best practice between other cities. You know, we share the same problems. Often the same solutions can help out. And some of the projects we've been involved in particularly was a clean bus declaration. And that is really showing the market, the world market in bus manufacturers and the manufacturers of clean, dry trains, be that electric, hydrogen, hybrid, whatever, that there is a market of, say, 40,000 units between now and the end of this decade of different cities across the world that want cleaner buses. We would all like to magic onto our streets, you know, the most amazing bus fleet in the world, you know, possible. But you've got to be realistic. We're all within fiscal envelopes. We can't impose too much on our residents when it comes to taxes and it comes to fares. But if we say to the market, there is a huge market for these buses, you can bring the cost down of these vehicles because of economies of scale, and it takes the development risk perhaps out of the system, so they know there are a huge customer base for them. And we've already seen, in fact, since our Clean Bus Summit here at the end of June of this year, you know, some of the prices have come down by 10%. And then it almost become no-brainers because the paybacks on those buses is so quick because of energy fuel efficiency, et cetera, that they're going to deploy really rapidly and at scale. So that is an example of cities working together, showing the market. Yes, all our bus markets are different. Our procurement models are often different. You know, London likes two bus entries because it gets rapid people going on and off. Other cities, even in England, like Manchester, like one door entry because of, you know, revenue control, revenue protection. But the fact that we all stand up and say we want all these cleaner buses, so the people who make the drive trains particularly can see that there's a market for them. Also on energy efficiency and retrofit in buildings, London's legal framework, we don't have the strongest levers like New York perhaps at mandating our commercial landlords and tenants to do retrofits, to do auditing and the rest of it. But working with C40, we found what other cities had similar sort of powers to us, what they had done to make it work. And we came up with the Mayor's Business Energy Challenge to, you know, set businesses a competition, a call to action, but also recognising the action that had been taken at making their buildings more energy efficient. And just last week, we had the second of our awards, and we've seen some astonishing work done by some of the big commercial players here in London, you know, reducing their energy use by 20% or so, just over just a few years. And if we see that kind of action over time, you can see how we can get to that target at 60% by mid-next decade.
Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, you and the mayor are folks that can really respect the degree to which the private sector's engagement can help scale good ideas, can help demonstrate and send even price signals that these are going to be successful investments with proper paybacks and everything else. Tell us a little bit more about C40 and who's involved and whether some of that private sector related engagement, where does that work and not work globally?
C40 is chaired currently by the mayor of Rio, Eduardo Paes, and it's really quite exciting. So I've been involved in it since I became the environment lead back in 2012. And at the Rio Plus 20 summit, I would say that Mayor Paes was on a fantastic show in the centre of the city. But we were, you know, I think we most would accept we were somewhat peripheral to the Rio Plus 20 events going on at their conference venue, which is some distance from city centre. Fast forward, three and a half years to the Paris COP, which is in just 2 weeks' time now. And we are seeing that cities and subnational players are playing a huge role in the events and in the conversation and in the drive to action at that COP. You know, we have our targets, which be 60% by 2025. Other cities have different targets, some more punishing than that, some less punishing. But And we've also got examples of real achievement. So, you know, London is, I'm going to quote our own figures, of, you know, 14% just in the last 7.5 years, despite that astonishing economic and population growth. And I think it's really very exciting that you hear Cristiano Figueres, you know, attending the C40 summit last year, being really involved in the conversations with the UN Special Envoy for Climate Change Cities, who also, coincidentally and very happily, is also the chairman of the C40 board, Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York. So you're really seeing that sort of political engagement at a high level with the UNFCCC. I'm going to get the right number of C's right. UNFCCC.
You got it. But I guess this whole you know, we keep hearing in the press that the UN is being more respectful of the role of these subnational players, which I guess means in part local government and industry. And we hear about sort of a climate change conference of which they'll be open to getting progress reports and commitments from a broader range of folks than just the premiers of the biggest countries in the world. How does that have the potential to change the dynamic in these climate change debates? I mean, what is it that the mayors bring to the table that could really help create some more momentum toward global commitment to this issue of climate change?
Well, I think quite a lot of it is actually leadership. So you're having, you know, some of the biggest sub-national politicians talking about this. So, you know, the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, is a very big politician here in the UK. The mayor of New York is an important mayor for New York, important politician in the United States. Mayor Pius in Rio is an important character. Mayor Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, is also an important politician, important leader for France. And you can map that across many countries in across the world. And the fact that they're signing up something called the Compact of Mayors, where they're going to set targets and publish their figures in a standardized format annually, so you can map progress. You can, their electorates can hold them to account, or wider civil society as they make progress to achieve that. I think that's one thing. It's showing that leadership, and also showing, in the case of London and other cities, that this is doable. It is doable in a way that is not unaffordable. It is doable in a way that actually increases the wealth and health of your citizens. There isn't a contradiction, I think, between taking climate action and impinging on the economic development of your country, of your city, and of your population. And I suppose there's also a message there, though, that there's a big climate finance point to make. So that, you know, doing the transition is going to cost capital money, but there is a payback. And in fact, Citibank did a fascinating report that they published in the last month, 6 weeks, called the Energy Darwinism 2, in which it showed that there is a benefit to doing the investment in taking climate action up over the next 30, 40 years or so. And that's not even calculating the environmental externalities. So I think showing that it is doable, and showing city leadership, showing us the leadership within our residents that we can do this, I think is a very important message, because you've seen national governments finding it perhaps politically more difficult to set the targets, to say they're going to deliver X, Y, and Z. But the fact that their cities and the residents in those cities are willing, capable, and are electing politicians who are willing to do that, I think shows you that all this is doable in a realistic, economically advantageous way.
Well, I can't help drawing a bit of a compare-contrast. In the United States, there's a great deal of caution and even suspicion of government. It's not even necessarily the suspicion of whether climate change is real or not, so much as that those who are particularly committed to addressing climate change maybe have a history of advancing the size of government, or have a philosophy that is more focused on government solving things. And yet, Boris Johnson's philosophy is also quite libertarian and conservative. Help me understand the connection between what makes Boris Johnson a conservative and what also makes him quite a hero on these environmental issues.
Well, I suppose the first thing is that, you know, he was quite captured on the efficiency side of this conversation. So he understands perfectly well that we all want to bring down our energy bills. So that's a very important, I think, message that is sometimes lost in some of the environmental lobbyist campaigners that you've described, they come at it as sort of, we need to save the planet. You shouldn't go on holiday because you've got to go on an airplane. You should feel guilty about, you know, pretty affluent lifestyles in the West. And that, you know, that's not going to capture most. You'll capture a portion of the population with that, clearly. But you're not going to capture most people. And where you can capture most people and take action is through some of the talk about, you know, efficiency in society. And, you know, why should you pay so much for your bills, your energy bills, the obvious thing, or why should it cost so much to fill up your car if you switch to a hybrid vehicle, or in due course, one hopes, an electric vehicle or hydrogen vehicle. So I think there's that. I think there's also a point is that, you know, light touch environmental regulation, and I'm going to give a great example from London, can actually grow the economy while cleaning up the air, and it's more air pollution driven, but also reduce carbon emissions. So the mayor has said that by 2018, all new taxis in London, newly licensed black cabs in London, need to be zero emission capable, probably some kind of petrol hybrid engine. By bringing that regulation in, he attracted some £250 million investment into the Midlands, not in London. You know, it would not have been perfect to be in London, but it wasn't. It's in Coventry, to make the taxis to fit this to meet these regulatory demands. And that shows you that that light touch regulation, well, actually not light touch, it's quite heavy regulation, actually. I should be more honest. Quite heavy regulation on the taxi trade has attracted hundreds of millions of pounds of investment into the United Kingdom to build the taxis in the UK. And when the taxis are running, their running costs are going to be substantially lower for those taxi drivers than the traditional diesel model. So you're seeing a real win-win-win with that regulation. Now, perhaps some of the more libertarian folks say, oh, my word, government regulation, that's an outrageous impingement of, you know, the liberty of the taxi driver to drive what vehicle he or she wants to drive. But I would say that, you know, when you put in that kind of regulation, which is fully thought through, engaging with the trade, engaging with the manufacturers, very importantly, to make sure these models will be actually viable and at a sensible price by the time it comes in, shows you the multiplicity of benefits that you can deliver. And that's really the mayor's way of working, in fact, is to take that sort of holistic approach, not a ideological approach, and it really has delivered benefits here.
Well, Matthew, that's a great way to end the discussion. Very, very impressive how basically the credibility that he has by having connected well with the private sector when he comes up even with regulatory strategies, the thought is that that they can be win-win-wins, as you point out. So it's been delightful talking to you. I am filled with some renewed confidence about what can be accomplished in Paris at the COP. And thank you and Boris for all you've done to move the ball forward. So thanks a lot, Matthew.
All right, thanks, Roger.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Climate Leaders. Join me next time for more insights from the world's climate experts as we explore the outlook for achieving COP21's bold objectives.